Okay, in the text, though, you may see it without the new. All right, write out the full paradigm for the verb grapho in the present indicative active. Okay, this is simply a matter of finding out what your stem is and then adding the same system of ending. So first person singular should be grapho. The stem is graph, and then you're just going to add these endings to it, the primary active endings. So we have grapho with omega, graphes, epsilon iota sigma, graphe, epsilon iota, graphomen, omicron mu, epsilon nu, graphete, epsilon tau epsilon, and graphusi or graphusin, omicron epsilon sigma iota nu. Okay? Any questions on that? So it's just a matter of applying the rule, and now I've just given you a different verb, which you haven't really seen the full paradigm for yet, and it's just exactly what you would expect. It's nice and regular, at least in the present. Okay? 12b, write out the full paradigm for the verb bluo in the future indicative active. Okay, it's really the same paradigm except that you've added a sigma. So it's luso, luces, luce, lusomen, lucete, and lususi or lususin. Okay? Any questions on the spelling of that? Just stick a sigma in there, and you have it. All right. Part B, write out the full paradigm for the verb grapho in the future indicative active. Okay, what feature is going to manifest itself on this set of forms? Yes, we're going to change to C because the stem ended in a phi, which is phonologically similar to P, and so you're adding a sigma to the phi, and that's going to become C by this change that you've seen at the end of chapter 12. So it becomes grapso with C, grapses, grapse, grapsomen, grapsete, and grapsusi, grapsusin. Okay? Nothing unusual about the endings. The endings are going to be the same, but your stem has changed according to this predictable phonological change. Now, actually, this kind of a verb would be categorized as regular, because even though that stem changes a little bit, it's really a phonological change demanded by a certain regular set of rules that's very predictable. And so, once you know that set of rules, it's very predictable in that respect. It's regular. Okay. Questions on any of that so far? Exercise 12C. Change each of the following forms to the corresponding form of the future tense. Retain the same person and number. So you're given a present tense form and you're asked to change it to a future tense form. Okay, therapuo, what's that going to be in the future? Anyway, therapuso, right, therapuso. No, nothing unusual here because the stem ends in epsilon upsilon, and so all we need to do is add the sigma in. So therapuso. Okay, gnoridze. What's that going to become in the future? Gnorisse, right. You just take the zeta out and put the sigma in. Remember with delta and theta and zeta, these, what they often call them as dental stems, they drop the letter out and put the sigma in. Okay. Kruptete. What's that going to become in the future? Krupsete, right. Krupsete. So the P tau, adding a sigma to that, becomes again C. Okay, dioxusin, what's that going to be in the future? Dioxusin, yes, dioxusin. Add the, change the kappa to xi. Okay, ktisomen, what's that going to be? Ktisomen, yes, ktisomen. Just a sigma instead of the zeta. Okay, kathises would be what? Kathises, right, kathises. And words like this, you've got to enunciate pretty carefully, too, because if you're a little sloppy in your enunciation, you could confuse the future with the present. All right. Strephomen, what would that be? Strepsomen, yes, yeah, strepsomen. Praso, proxo, right, proxo. Lue, luce. Notice this lue is different than the other lue. Got omicron upsilon diphthong here instead of just upsilon. This word means to wash as opposed to bathe or to wash as opposed to the other luo, which was to loose. Okay, and there's really, in our pronunciation system, there's no real difference between the pronunciation. Okay, and I'm not sure if any other pronunciation system makes much difference on that either. Okay, hekete becomes what? Hekzete. Right, the kappa changes to xi. Any problems with any of those? Anybody having any trouble identifying what letter needs to be changed, if any, and so forth? Again, essentially involves knowing what the endings are. If you see a form, you can lop off the ending part, see what the stem is, and then to convert to future, add the sigma in and do whatever is required according to the rules on that. If the stem ends in a vowel or a diphthong, it's very simple. You just add the sigma. If the stem, however, ends in one of these consonants, there's a phonological change required. Okay? 12D then. Using the vocabulary given, translate the English into Greek. So he's giving you some more verbs for vocabulary here. Luo, I loose. Akuo, I hear. Grapho, I write. Baptizo, I baptize. Dioko, I persecute or pursue. Tempo, I send. Ago, I lead. And patho, I persuade. Okay, so with that information, you're asked to translate each of the following English things into Greek. Number one, you singular are loosing. What's that going to be? Luace. Yes, luace. The spelling should be lambda, ypsilon, epsilon, yod, sigma. Number two, he hears. What should that be? Akue. Akue. Present tense, so it should be alpha, kappa, omicron, ypsilon, epsilon, iota. Number three, we are sending. Pempomen. Pempomen. P, epsilon, mu, P, omicron, mu, epsilon, nu, excuse me. Okay, number four, you plural will be writing. Grapsete, yes, grapsete. You need future form here. You will be writing, so that should be a gamma rho alpha c epsilon tau epsilon, and it's you plural. Now, of course, they're having to designate whether it's you singular or plural. English doesn't make this discrimination between the singular and the plural in the second person. So, in order to know what form you want in Greek, they're adding the information plural there or singular on the yous. Okay, number five, he will persuade. Pese, yes. P epsilon iota, sigma epsilon iota. From patho, see patho has the theta there, and that theta drops out and the sigma replaces it in the future. So pese. In number six, you plural will persecute. Dioxete. Dioxete, right. The verb is dioko with a kappa. In the future, since we want future form here, we're going to have to put xe on there, and since we want it second person plural, the U plural, it's going to be the ete ending, epsilon tau epsilon. So dioxete. Okay, number seven, you singular will baptize. Okay, baptises, baptises, with a sigma rather than the zeta. Again, because of the future form. So it's beta alpha p tau iota sigma epsilon iota sigma. Okay, number eight, they will send. Pimpsusin or Pimpsusi, right, Pimpsusin. P, epsilon, mu, C, omicron, upsilon, sigma, iota, nu. Okay, and the nu is optional. Number nine, we shall lead. Oxomen, right, from ago. The gamma is going to become C when the sigma is added to it. So it's oxomen, alpha with smooth breathing, C, omicron, mu, epsilon, nu. Now the new on that ending is not optional. It's definitely has to be there. Okay, number 10, they are writing. Okay, graphusin, or graphusi, right, graphusin. Gamma, rho, alpha, phi, omicron, epsilon, sigma, iota, nu. What if I want to say they will be writing? Yeah, that would be graphusin. Or you just change the phi is to psi and you have it in the future. Okay, 12e. Put an X in the parentheses before the verb form, which will be grammatically appropriate in the blank space in the sentence to the left of it. Okay, so your main concern here, to make it grammatically appropriate, you're going to have to be concerned with the rule of concord, which requires that the verb is going to agree with the subject in person and number. So, number one, we've got tus doulos ho prophetes. Which verb form will fit that? Luce. Okay, that's the only one that'll fit. Because that's the only one that's third person singular. You've got to have a third person singular. So luetes, what form? Let's parse all of these, okay? Luetes what? Second person plural, right? And luusi, or luusin, third person plural. And the final form, lususi. Yeah, and that's future. Of course, they're not really telling us whether they want singular or present or future. That would fit except that it's third person plural. That's the problem. So you've got to have a third-person singular form, luce, and it's a future form as well. Number two, hoi douloi tein basilisan blank. what verb form is going to fit that? Okay, lu'usin, right. So first thing you need to do is decide what is your subject, and your subject is going to be in the nominative case. So hoi doulo is the subject, and the nominative case happens to be plural. So what you need is a third person plural verb form, and that's the only one that's third person plural. The next one is lu'es is what person number is that?
Second
singular, right. And luce is third singular, and lu'e is third singular. Okay. Number three, tas hamartias tu la'u ho theos blank. Kalupse, yes, kalupse, third form down. It's the only one you need, again, a third person singular. And the first one is third person plural, second one is second person plural, and the last one is second person singular. Okay. Yes.
Every time we've had theos in our textbooks, it's always been an indented case. So here's the first example where we've had an indented case down on theos.
Oh, yes, you've had, now you've got, well, tas hamartias tu la'u is the sins of the people. And so tu la'u is a genitive case on, genitive modifier to the word hamartias. Ho theos is nominative, that's your subject. Okay? And you've seen tu theu and so forth in the genitive form in other exercises, but this would be your nominative form for it. And so this is the subject of the sentence. Is that the one you're referring to, or are you referring to the tu la'u there?
Every time we've seen
gender phrase
with God in it.
Oh. Oh, I see. Well, that's just I think it's just a matter of the examples that were chosen. There's nothing intrinsically. You will see the word God in genitive very often because there's so many words in the New Testament that are characterized as being of God. You know, the gospel of God, the word of God, and so forth. So you see those terms very frequently in the New Testament. That's probably why the examples are very frequent in that respect. But God does do things, too, and so he's in the nominative case numerous times as well. And the accusative, pros ton theon, there's a place where it's accusative. Yes?
What would you do if you have a sentence where you had this simple nominative accusative in the same basic structure? They have the genitive kind of stuck in between them.
Oh.
You have to decide which one it went to.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, like even here. It's possible, I suppose, tu la'u ho theos. You could almost put the tu la'u with ho theos there in that... first position there, first attributive position. Well, you've got the article hold there. Yeah, you could. Yeah, that could be. It could be the first predicate. So, kind of tough. You have to, again, it's your context. It's a primary determining factor. You see, if it was first attributive position, then you'd tend to see, you'd see ho tu la'u theos. That would be first attributive. And the first predicate, though, this could be considered a predicate position, a predicate position involved here. So, you know, see the whole genitive phrase, it'd be just like an adjective and predicate position. So, it's possible. But, you see, remember again that the most common position for the genitive phrase is in that position following the word. And when you have a case where it's ambiguous, then use that to determine it. And of course, context also will help, too. Okay. Was there another question here or observation about that? Usually they'll try to avoid that by splitting it up with some other words in between. But you know, once in a while you may see it and there may be enough context to determine it. Should be enough. Okay. Number four, tu flus blank ho Jesus. What verb form is going to fit? Therapeuse. Yes, therapeuse. We get our word therapeutics. So we're from that. It means to heal. And so Jesus healed the blind and so forth. So we've got, that is the only third person singular form. Ho Jesus is the subject, so we need third person singular. And two of them are third person plural, and the last one is second person plural. Okay, number five, blank ton apostolon hi ecclesiae. What verb form is going to fit? Pemsusin, last verb form there, yes. The only one, see, hi ecclesiae is your subject. Nominative case, and it's plural. So we've got to have a third person plural form. It's the only one that fits. Okay, then number six, blank, ta tekna ton kurion which is going to fit there? Okay, doxaze. Doxaze. Yes, that's the only one that's going to fit. And what's the reason for that? Looks like it's wrong, because tau techna is plural. Okay, a neuter plural can take a singular verb form. Now, if they had doxazusi here, you could have chosen that as well, but they purposely didn't do that so that you'd be forced to remember this rule, remember this exception. So they've given you some plural forms, but they give you a first-person plural and a second-person plural and a second-person singular. The only thing that can possibly work is a third-person singular here. But you might see this with a third-person plural also. Okay? So that's just a reminder of that little rule. Questions? Any problems or difficulties with that?
I have a question on the movable new and when you use it now.
Okay. Basically, you'll use it. Let's put it this way. It may be used in cases where the word following starts with a consonant, but most often it'll be used when it's kind of just a general rule. It's not a hard and fast thing. You may or may not see it in almost any situation, but generally, if the word following starts with a vowel, you'll see the new on there. And if the word following starts with a consonant, you may or may not see it. But if the word following starts with a vowel, you'll see the new on there. It kind of makes a definite consonantal ending to that word, and then you begin in the next word with a vowel sound. So you have to kind of look for the word following it, and that will usually determine it. So, for example, in number 4 here, on the example 12e, number 4, tus tu flus blank ho Jesus, they've given you some false choices here. Therapeutusin, that's not the one that fits in there, but they did put a new on there, probably because the next word began with ho, and it was a vowel sound. So that's what you would, if the word would have fit in there, they probably would have had a new on it. But, yeah, go ahead.
I'm just aware that on section 12D,
top 9,
oxygen.
Yes.
Okay. I don't understand why that has to be excused. In fact, I have the rule if you thought a word following.
Oh, okay. That's because this is a different ending. Oxomen is the one you want for number 9. First person plural. Now the first person plural has a new. Omen doesn't have that new is not movable on omen.
Oh.
Only on usin. You see, only on the third person plural is that new movable. The new on the omen is always there, regardless. That's an intrinsic part of the ending.
Right.
Okay? So that's the only reason on that one.
So in general, whenever we see a word that starts with a vowel, following.
Right.
Then we always put it on.
More than likely, yeah. So, in other words, if you're looking for a rule of thumb for your own composition, that's probably a good rule to use. I wouldn't count you wrong if you didn't have the new on there, because it's not a hard and fast ironclad thing, but there's a tendency to put that new in there when the word following begins with a vowel. Okay? And if you just want to adopt a habit of putting it in all the time, that'll be fine too. But the main thing to be, the reason to be aware that it's sometimes there and sometimes not, is that when you're reading the text of the New Testament, sometimes you'll see it and sometimes you won't, so that you're not thrown into consternation or fail to recognize what you're looking at. That's the main reason. Okay? Yes?
Would that apply more to an actual vowel or vowel sound, like
holding, Yeah, it's got more of an H sound. I think it's generally true, just a vowel sound. Whether it's a rough or smooth breathing, there's a vowel afterwards. And they're not really thinking of a H sound like we think of it as a consonant. They're thinking of it more of as just a rough breathing is what it is. You just breathe rough on that pronunciation of the vowel is all. Okay? And you might, when we start, doing more translating, more looking at the text, just kind of watch for these, and you'll begin to pick up the pattern yourself, and you'll see that it's not hard and fast. It's not an ironclad rule. Okay. Going now to lesson 13, unless there's any other questions on any of these forms. We've dealt with the present and the future, and the present is formed by simply adding the primary active endings. The future is formed by adding a sigma to the base, and then adding the primary active endings. The complications that exist are that in the future, Some of them are irregular, and for one reason or another, they can't take a sigma. So we really haven't dealt with many of those, but some of them are very irregular. There's a stem change, but the endings are going to be consistent. And then others have a regular phonological change as a result of the addition of the sigma. Those that end in a P beta phi or P tau become C. Those that end in a kappa gamma chi or double sigma become C. And those that end in delta theta or zeta drop that letter and become just the sigma. Okay, lesson 13 then. We want to deal with the past tenses of the indicative active. And the two tenses we're going to deal with here are the imperfect and the aorist. And we talked about the fact, and the thing we just got to yesterday as we began this chapter, is the fact that in the present and in the future, there's only one set of forms in Greek that are used to convey both the progressive aspect and the indefinite aspect. And you have to decide on the basis of context which aspect is being stated in a particular case. So luo corresponds to both I loose, indefinite aspect, and I am loosing, the progressive aspect. And luso corresponds to both I shall loose, indefinite aspect, and I shall be loosing, giving the progressive aspect. Now, in the past, however, we have two different sets of forms to indicate each of these two meanings. So we can, without any ambiguity in the past, decide whether the Greek is talking about a progressive action or an indefinite action. So for indicating action action in past time, however, Greek verbs have two sets of forms. Forms of one kind usually express the aspect we have called progressive. These forms make up the tense called the imperfect. Okay, and he gives a footnote on that word tense just because really imperfect and aorist are both the same tense idea, both past tense. The difference between them is not one of time, it's one of aspect. So he just qualifies that. But the term tense is used for these pretty standardly, so we won't worry about that. Forms of the second kind usually express the indefinite aspect. These forms make up the tense called the aorist, which we talked about yesterday, from aoristos, meaning indefinite. So the very meaning of the word aorist is indefinite. Okay, so take a look then. We've got the model verb luo again now in both the imperfect and the aorist. Now if you look at those two sets of paradigms, realizing that luo was the base, you'll see several things. First of all, in the imperfect, we've got luon for I was loosing, lus for you were loosing, lun for he, she, or it was loosing, luomen for we were loosing, luete for they, you plural were loosing, and luon for we plural were loosing. And then for the aorist, you've got elusa for I loosed, elusas for you loosed, elusen for he, she, or it loosed, elusamen for we loosed, elusate for you plural loosed, and elusan for they loosed. Now, looking at these forms, what features can you observe? What observations can you make about these forms on the basis of realizing that luo was the original? Lu is the stem. Okay, that's the first feature you notice. They've all got an epsilon in the front. So all of these forms, every one of them has an epsilon in the front. We'll take note of that. This is what's called the augment. And the epsilon is an indicator of past time. You see epsilon in the past tense forms. And both aorist and imperfect have the epsilon. So that epsilon is transmitting some information. You could call it a morpheme that's indicating past time. That's really what the augment is. Yes?
Would that be true in other verbs?
It'll be true on any verb. It'll be true on any verb. The only complications arise when the verb begins with a vowel. And when you try to add an epsilon to a vowel, there'll be some phonological changes, which may make it not quite as obvious that the augment is there, but that'll be on the next page here. Is it next page? Yeah, we'll get to it in the next page. Okay. But as long as the verb begins with a consonant, that's what you'll see. Okay, we'll get to these things in the perfect and the pluperfect and so forth too. We'll see augments there too, because they're both dealing with past time. Yes?
The aorist takes a sigma after the
base. Okay, right. There's another feature to observe. The aorist has a sigma on it after the base, whereas the imperfect does not. The imperfect just has a set of endings on it. But the aorist has a sigma before you get to the endings. Elusa, see. You've got the sigma again before the set of endings. All right, and what about the endings themselves? Are they the same word? Yes, you got it right. two whole new sets of paradigms to learn, actually, because the imperfect endings are different than the aorist endings, and the imperfect endings and the aorist endings are both different than the primary active endings we've seen before for the present and the future. Now, you will see that the sum of the endings are the same. Well, I guess only one set, really. The third person singular is both epsilon nu in both the aorist and the imperfect. But otherwise, what major characteristic feature do you see? Basically, the aorist have alpha-type endings. You see alphas all the way through, whereas the imperfect have either omicron or epsilon as your first vowel there. And this is a distinction we'll talk about more later on. They have the grammarians use what they term a thematic vowel. In other words, a vowel that's a theme for a certain set of endings. And for the aorist, the thematic vowel is alpha. For the imperfect, it's more of omicron or epsilon. You see O or S sounds. And so the imperfect is more like the primary active endings in that the endings are usually O or epsilon sounds. Whereas the aorist has these characteristic alpha endings. Yes?
I think we don't have a movable nu here.
No, only in the... Well, they didn't indicate it here, but that third person singular is actually a movable nu. That's the only one you have. Third person singular, where L-U-N, for example, they didn't really indicate it here, but they will in the paradigm on the next pages. But that is movable. But that's the only form. Third person singular now is the only one that's got the movable nu. I think that was mentioned in the footnote when he first introduced that. He said that there would be third person endings, or some endings with epsilon that did that. So... Yes, John?
Well, there's some other somewhat regularity to this, and the other one is second person in both tenses it ends in the sigma.
Right.
And that is the same way it was in the present.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then also in a first person plural,
right.
You've got a mu, epsilon, nu.
Right.
And then you've got tau, epsilon on
right.
The second person.
And then just and you're new on the third person plural. See, the only difference is own versus on. Okay, that's a good observation
well,
again.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
see,
it's movable new on the.
It's movable new on the third person singular, but not on the plural. On the third person plural here on these forms.
No, I meant in comparing it to the present and future.
Oh, in comparing it to the present.
Yeah,
okay,
just
back there. All right.
Through also, will we see that in the other ones?
Well. I think the observations you've made is about the only observations you can make. We will actually later on. I don't think he's going to do this right away. Let me just check.
Well, that's helpful though, if you know
yes.
The second person singular ends in sigma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and is that the way it is?
Yes, those will be consistent. Those will be pretty consistent. Actually, we don't have too many more endings to worry about. We've got our major ending systems. Only when we get to the perfects and the pluperfects is where we'll be dealing with some other endings. And aorist passive also has got some. But even there, you're going to see a different thematic vowel, but again, some things that you can draw parallels to. And when we get all of our ending systems done, what we're going to do is he breaks it down into morphemes. And what you've observed about the last part of it being the same, but the first part being a little bit different, what we're going to do is split these things up into two morphemes. And one morpheme is going to indicate one thing, and the other morpheme is going to indicate another thing. And so one morpheme will be called a tense formant, and the other morpheme will be called a person number suffix. And that last part, like the men and the te and so forth, the parts that seem to be in common, that'll be person number suffix. Whereas the other will be a more of a tense formant, something to indicate the tense of this particular system. Yes, Dan?
Oh, it looks like the accent is shifted to the first syllable, where...
Okay, good point. Yeah, your accent is off on the first syllable. Now, this is going to be part of the verb accent rules that we'll look at, and I'm not going to worry about that too much right away. I'd rather have you get the endings all down and so forth and get pretty comfortable with that, and then we'll talk about these accents. But there's a tendency, the general rule, the general idea in verb forms is that the accent tends to get as far to the front of the word as it can, according to the rules. So that means it's usually going to be on the antepenult if it can be. But it can't always be because some of the endings, like amen or omen, for example, there's two syllables on the ending. And if there's two syllables on the word and so forth, you see you ended up with, you've got a four-syllable word, so it can't be on the first syllable anymore. Remember, the accent can only stand on one of the last three syllables of a word. And so we've got... L-U-S, L-U-N, but L-U-O-M-E-N. See, the accent had to shift because you couldn't have L-U-O-M-E-N. You know, you just got too many syllables afterwards. So the accent has to shift on that form. Okay, and L-U-A-T-A, the same thing. Two syllables there in the ending. So that's an interesting observation. I'm glad somebody caught that. But we'll talk about that some more later on when we get to accent rules for verbs. But the general tendency for the accent in a verb is to get as close to the front of the word as it can, according to the rules. Okay. Then, anyone else with another observation? I think you pretty well covered them. Okay, now let's break this down and in more detail. Careful attention should be given to the following points. Number one, all the forms in both paradigms have a prefixed morpheme epsilon. This is called the augment. The augment is present only in the past tenses of the indicative mood. Okay? So that is the imperfect and the aorist, sometimes the pluperfect. And but this is only in all voices. In other words, the actives, the passives, and the middles will all have the augment. But it's only in the indicative mood. When we get to optatives and subjunctives and so forth, we won't need an augment. You don't have to worry about that yet. Okay. If the verb begins with a consonant, it has in the past tenses an augment in the form of the prefixed epsilon, as here. If a verb begins with a vowel or a diphthong, the augment consists of a modification of this vowel or diphthong as follows. So they don't like to add an epsilon to another vowel sound. And so instead of adding an epsilon, there'll be some sort of a change, generally a change in the direction of lengthening the vowel. So suppose that the verb begins with an alpha, for example, here. He's got a little chart here indicating what's going to happen. If the word begins with an alpha and you put it into a past tense, where you're going to need an augment, instead of putting an epsilon on front of the alpha, they convert the alpha to an eta. So akuo, for example, is an example of that. Akuo begins with alpha. In the imperfect, it's akuon. Notice that the alpha has become an eta. So think of it, in your mind, you might think of it as the alpha got an epsilon onto it, and that turned it into an eta. And an eta is a long E sound, so you can kind of get the connection. Same thing with an epsilon. If the word begins with an epsilon already, the putting the augment on it will turn it into an eta. So elpizo, for example, becomes elpizon. Elpizon. Eta there in the augmented form. If the word begins with an omicron, it'll get lengthened to omega. So ophalo becomes ophalon with an omega when the augment is on it. If it begins with the iota, nothing happens really. Except maybe it becomes long. That's what he's indicated here. It becomes long in sound. So iskuo becomes iskuon. And when you get the accent on it, you tend to pronounce things with a long E anyway. So iskuon, I guess you would say. And the upsilon becomes a longer upsilon. And we don't really make a difference in pronunciation of those, so it's not going to sound any different. So if the word begins with an upsilon, so hugiaino, for example, is going to be hugiainon in the imperfect, and only thing there you're going to see really to know the difference is the ending. Hugiaion. What was that? Yeah, the accent shifts. That's just because this. Well, yes, that's a good point. The accent shifts the other direction in this one, because in these other forms. You want to get the accent as far toward the front as you possibly can. Most of the other ones, though, are doing that anyway. What was that?
You're trying to get it on the upsilon, but you can't.
Right, you can't get it on the upsilon, so you got it close as you could, you got it on the iota. Okay? So, regardless of where it is, you see, most of these other words have accent shifts, too, in the imperfect. Akuo, you see, becomes akuon. And so the accent tries to get to the front. That's basically what's happening in these imperfect forms, these past forms. Whenever you stick the augments and things like that on, tries to move to the front. Now, you don't really know how to predict where the accent's going to come on the present form. You have to learn that as a part of it. It's just like with the nouns, you have to learn that as a part of the word. And then, once you know where it is, then you can have some pretty reasonable ideas as to where it's going to go in the rest of the forms. Okay. The lengthening of iota and upsilon to long iota and long upsilon is not represented in ordinary texts, though sometimes is in grammatical works. So that apparently there's some debate about that, because you don't really see any change in the form, so He's considering it that way, but it doesn't really change pronunciation that much. Okay, then diphthongs, alpha iota. If alpha iota begins the word, then it's going to become eta with the iota subscript when it's augmented. So you can kind of think of it as just a subcategory of what happened to the alpha. Remember, the alpha became an eta. Alpha iota becomes eta iota, in effect, but the iota is a subscript. So iro becomes aeron with epsilon, eta with the iota subscript on it. Alpha upsilon becomes eta upsilon, and that's pretty much predictable again, just to think of the alpha becoming eta, and you have it. So auxano becomes euxanon, and eta upsilon takes the place of alpha upsilon. Omicron iota becomes omega with the iota subscript. And so so oiktero becomes oktero with omega with the iota subscript. And epsilon upsilon becomes eta upsilon. So heurisko becomes heuriskon, heuriskon, and it's got a rough breathing, and you really pronounce that before the eta there, even though it's on the upsilon. It's considered a diphthong, see, eu, eu, instead of eu, it's eu. And you might, though, however, see sometimes epsilon upsilon is sometimes left unchanged. So heuriskon you may see also. So in this case, it's not always, you know, predictable which way it's going to go. That's why you have that chart in the back of the principal parts, because that, in memorizing that chart, you'd a lot of these that do these funny things are going to be indicated there, so you'll know which one it does. Yes.
Is there then another principal ending of another tense that we haven't learned yet, where that would be confused with the aorist past? Or the imperfect past? Pardon me. You see. Because if this is left unchanged, then you don't essentially, you don't know whether that's, you know, aorist
or
imperfect.
Oh, okay.
Or something
right.
That we haven't learned yet, just because of the mm-hmm. ending.
Well, generally, that omicron nu ending isn't going to be a problem, because you won't see that omicron nu ending in any present or future forms. The only thing you might confuse this with is what's called a second aorist. And that's going to come up later in this chapter, because a second aorist will also take this same kind of an ending. But so you won't confuse it time-wise, but the aspect may be confused. And the difference is going to be some stem change that you have to learn as well. So to my knowledge, you won't get, if you know all of the facets to it, you won't get these things confused. But if you look at the ending alone, you might get them confused. And the fact that the augment doesn't really appear, that's not going to be too much of a problem, just because the ending systems are different. In other words, without the augment, the only thing you might confuse, you know, the lack of the, if it's the same with and without the augment, the only issue of confusion might be, is it past tense or is it present or future? But the endings are going to be sufficiently different to indicate that. You won't see any problem there. So that shouldn't be a problem. The only problem you might have, though, is wondering whether it's aorist or imperfect, because some of the aorists will take the same kind of ending. So that puts a burden on you to know whether this is an imperfect or a second aorist. And I guess I don't want to say too much more about that till we get to second aorist, so you see what actually happens. But second aorists will take the imperfect type of endings. And but they do something else instead of taking the alpha type endings. They change the stem and take the imperfect endings, and that's how you can tell them. You can tell them, but because of the stem change. Okay, epsilon iota is always left unchanged. So erenuo becomes erenuon. Erenuon, excuse me, is an accent shift. But as far as the epsilon is concerned, the augment doesn't change it at all. Okay, now, secondly, the forms of the imperfect are obtained by A, augmenting the present base as described above, and B, adding the endings on, s, e, with the optional nu, omen, ete, and on. So here's your imperfect type endings, and you form the imperfect by adding the augment to the base and then adding these endings. And adding the augment to the base is usually a pretty simple process, except when the base begins with a vowel and the rules above need to be applied there to decide exactly what's going to become. Yes, Rick?
Is there any rhyme or reason to why they have the moon and switch it around? Here is the same year before as the
I really don't know. I really couldn't say, other than perhaps third-person singular and third-person plural forms are probably your most commonly seen forms. you know, in narrative. You're seldom talking in a text of scripture or something like that in a written document. You're going to be more often seeing third person forms than other forms. So maybe phonological change is going to be more important with third person forms since they're more commonly used. That's the only thing I could even guess at as to why that's the case. But other than that, I really don't have anything to say about it. Okay. Note that the first person singular and third person plural are identical in form. Notice the ending. Omicron nu, first person singular and third person plural. So guess how you tell whether you're looking at a first person singular or third person plural form? A context. Context. And usually it's not that difficult because the noun, see, if it's a third person plural form, the noun will be in the plural. And it really can't be anything else. And the only case is if there's no stated subject, that's where you get the most ambiguity, because then it could be I or they. But in the context, if it's a narrative talking about some people that are doing something and you haven't even introduced yourself into the picture at all, then it's going to be pretty obvious. So it's not that big of a problem as it turns out. Okay, then, thirdly, the forms of the aorist are obtained by A, augmenting the present base, B, adding sigma, and then C, adding the endings alpha, alpha sigma, epsilon with movable nu, amen, ata, and an. So we have a different system of endings. We add the sigma to the base also, and then also the augment like we did with the imperfect. And the same rules will apply to the adding the augment there as did above. In other words, if you're adding the augment to a vowel sound or something, the same exact rule system applies. Note that the endings of the imperfect are similar to but not the same as those of the aorist, but that neither set of endings is the same as the primary endings found in the present and future tenses. So we've got three separate systems of endings, some parallels between them, but they're really three separate systems of endings, and we need to learn them as such. You can go ahead if you'd like to and write the paradigms for these endings, the primary active we had in the previous chapter, and then these two systems of endings. I'm going to wait a little bit before we give you a full paradigm on the board until we get a few more things added into the picture, but we'll go ahead and do that before too long. Okay, number four. The rule given for the formation of the imperfect admits of few exceptions. There's only very few exceptions, what he's trying to say. And so one exception is echon rather than echon with an eta is the imperfect of echo. So you would have expected just to see echo begins with an epsilon, the augment, you would have expected to turn that into an eta. You would expect an echon with an eta. But it turns out that it's echon with epsilon iota. So that's one of the few exceptions. That's about the only one I can think of that's an exception in the imperfect. I think there's a few others too, but they're a lot, you know, less frequent. So his point is that you don't see very many exceptions to the rules for forming the imperfect. The imperfect is one of the most predictable tenses in terms of formation that you'll see. And because of that, there's no need to make the imperfect a principal part, because it's normally so regular that it can be ascertained from the first principal part just by the rules. And therefore, it's not a separate principal part. So the imperfect is accordingly not one of the principal parts of a verb. The rule for forming the aorist, on the other hand, admits of a number of exceptions of various kinds. The first person singular of the aorist indicative active is hence the third principal part of a verb. Okay, so now we've got our third principal part. That's the aorist form. Because the aorist formation has a number of exceptions, it's necessary then to make that the third principal part so that we have an assurance of making all the rest of the forms accurately. So now we've got three principal parts. The first person principal part is your first person singular indicative active, your future form, first person singular indicative future form, and then your first person singular of the aorist is your third principal part. Now, yes?
If the imperfect is more different than the present, than the future.
Yes.
But the future is considered a second and the imperfect isn't.
Right. Right. The problem, though, is that the futures aren't always as regular. In other words, there are a number of irregular futures where no sigma is added at all, where the stem is changed, where lots of oddball things happen instead of putting a sigma on. And it's the thing that determines principal parts isn't really how much junk is stuck on to the front and the end of the word, you know, how many prefixes and suffixes are stuck on. It's really a function of how regularly formed those things are. In other words, if the rules that govern the formation of a certain form are almost always regular and you can always predict what's going to happen, if you know the rules, then there's no need to make it a principal part. It's true that the imperfect form is more different from the present form than the future form is in form. But the imperfect is more regularly formed. In other words, if you know what the present stem is, you can make the imperfect and hardly ever run into an exception. You can, just by knowing that you stick an augment on and stick these endings on, you can make any imperfect form, if you know the present base, and not have to worry about a lot of exceptions. But if you know the present base and try to form a future form from that, knowing the rules that you know, you'll be right a good percentage of the time, but you'll be wrong a lot more than you would be with the imperfect. In other words, there's a number of exceptions, like crino, for example, becomes crino, and so forth. We'll get into a number of them. So it's just a matter of the number of exceptions there are to the rules that determines whether something's a principal part or not. Same with the aorist. The aorist has a pattern also, but there's a lot of exceptions to it. And so because there's a lot of exceptions, it's really incumbent to know what that principal part is in order to be able to make the form. So that's really the distinction that they're trying to observe here as far as deciding what's a principal part or not. It's really not how much stuff is put on something, but how regularly formed they are, how easy they are to form if you know a simple rule. And the imperfect, if you just know the rule that you add the augment and add the system of endings, you pretty much have it. There's only a very few exceptions to that rule. Okay, and you'll see too, let me see if I can point out one. If you look at that chart on the principal parts, when it comes to the imperfect, of course, there's no separate form for the imperfect. But they will often make a footnote or something on this, indicating that the imperfect is irregular, probably with echo.
Yeah.
Yes. Look at the bottom of page 330. Echo. Right underneath the word, it's got parentheses, imperfect echon. So they're just telling you that this one's got an irregular imperfect. And you'd have to know that information, really. Is there any others in this chart? Well, there's one over mellow. On the next page, page 331, about the 6th, 7th one up, something like that, 8th one up from the bottom, mellow is the imperfect amelone or emelone. So that's not really an exception. Emelone is the predictable form, but they're saying that there's an irregular amelone also. So that's the kind of thing that they'll just make a note on that, just because there's not enough of them to make a separate principal part out of the imperfect. There's just a few that have exceptions to the basic rule. Okay? Even though the form is quite different, it's a predictably different form, you see. The rules will tell you how to make it without many exceptions. Okay, any other questions on that? All right, point number five then is next. When sigma is added to the augmented present base to form the aorist base, the same kind of modifications that are made in the final consonants of the base are made as are made when the sigma is added to the form of the future base are needed. So, just like we saw in the future, when you in the aorist, when you're adding a sigma to the base, the exact same phonological changes occur. So, if you add a sigma onto a kappa, it becomes C. Add a sigma onto a P, it becomes C. Same exact system of rules. So that chart that you memorized back there is good for these as well. So look at the examples here, and you'll see that and be able to observe it. If the base ends in a P, like pimpo, the future we've seen is pimpso, and the aorist is epimsa, epimsa. And notice again the C there instead of a P sigma. Okay, if the base ends in a beta, like tribo, the future is tripso, and the aorist is etripsa. With a C. If the base ends in phi, like grapho, again the future we've seen is grapso, and the aorist is egrapsa. The base ends in p tau, like calupto, to hide, we have calupso for the future and ekalupsa for the aorist. Dioko becomes dioxo in the future, et dioxa in the aorist. And the base in ending in gamma, like anoigo, we've got anoixo and anoixa. Why the eta there in the front of the aorist? Yes, the augment on an alpha is going to turn into eta. So that's just reflecting the existence of the augment. Yes?
Why is not the past imperfect part one of the principal parts? They just have the aorist.
Okay, the reason that the imperfect is not one of the principal parts is just because it's formed so regularly. by the rules, that they don't need to make it a separate. See, the principal parts are only what they're intended to be is the minimum number of forms that are necessary to be able to make all the forms of the verb. The minimum number of forms necessary. And they didn't consider the imperfect as being necessary because it can be formed from the first principal part by very regular rules. You just take the first principal part, put the augment on it, lop off the present endings and put on the imperfect endings and you have it. So there's no need to put it as a separate principal part because it's got so few exceptions that you can make it regularly from the rules. Whereas the aorist has a number of exceptions to it, and therefore, and the future also, so they needed to be separate principal parts. Because for an average verb, you can't count on every verb being regular. And so you need to know these forms to really be able to know for sure what it's going to do. Okay, but almost every verb, with very few exceptions, you know, you'll be able to tell how to form the imperfect if you just know the present. Okay, let's see. We've got base ending in chi, elenko, to expose, the future elenkso, and the aorist elenksa. Keruso, to preach, becomes keruxo in the future, and ek keruxa in the aorist. Spudo, meaning to hasten, becomes spuso, and espusa, in the aorist. Same change, the sigma instead of the delta. Base ending in theta, peso in the future, the theta drops out, the sigma replaces it, and epesa in the aorist. And the base ending in zeta, baptizo, same thing, baptiso in the future, and ebaptisa for the aorist. Okay? Now, of course, these are all first-person singular forms in this whole chart. The other forms, of course, would have just the same stem, same augment, just a different ending. Okay, questions on those. So what you've learned for the future applies to the aorist, at least for the regular ones. All right, number six. Verbs which have aorist forms with the endings given in three above are said to have first aorists. So the kinds of endings, these alpha-type endings are the endings that go on first aorists. Now that he's distinguished first aorists, you know that you're probably looking for something else too. And lo and behold, there are second aorists. And so if you've ever seen these terms in, you know, when you're parsing forms doing Greek word studies, and you'll see first aorist and second aorist sometimes, this is what this is referring to. Now, a first aorist and a second aorist mean the same thing. They have the same meaning. In other words, they don't have any difference in meaning. They're both aorist ideas, and the only difference between a first and second aorist is in the way that they form their, in the forms themselves. Specifically, the second aorists have a different system of endings. They use these imperfect endings again, and they have some sort of a stem change that's indicating the aorist. So we're out of time here. We'll have to talk about this concept of first and second aorists tomorrow. So we don't have any assignments for tomorrow. I'll just be thinking about these things. And tomorrow, too, since it's the last, let's see, the test is going to be on next Tuesday, isn't it? So that'll be the last day before the test. If you have any questions on those previous chapters, 7 to 11, and those accent rules, be sure and bring them up tomorrow so that you're all ready.
Why have first and second aorists if they have the same meaning and it's just a matter of...
Well, it has to do with the way the forms are made.
Like first and second declension idea.
Yeah, why have two declensions? Yeah. It's hard to give a good answer for that. I suppose we just have to say that's the way it is. But the essential problem is that sometimes it's hard to add a sigma, just like in the future. Some words they don't like to add sigmas to. And so instead of adding a sigma to it, they'll change the stem. And then in changing the stem, in order to not confuse that with the imperfects or something of that nature, they'll change it and put a different system of endings on it too. So we'll actually look at it. And I don't know what we can say about the philosophy behind it, but it's very definitely the case that there's a good number of them that are second aorists.
Well, there may be some good reasons.
There may be. I may not be obvious.